This evening we are about days away from Purim, and we turn our attention to Megillas Esther, and we find ourselves in the third perek. Last couple of years we dealt with the first two chapters. As we will see, some of what happens in the beginning of Perek Gimel is actually very much connected to elements of the first two prokim, so we will recap where relevant. And in fact, the connection begins immediately in the beginning of the perek, achar hadvarim ha'ele, after these things, these matters, gidal ha'melech ha'chashverosh es Haman ben Amdasa ha'gogi vayinas ehu. So the king promotes Haman. So here we are. There are Jewish children that have been waiting desperately for the first two chapters of Megillas Esther. No mention of Haman at all. They're about to leave, and then Haman enters. And of course, the question is, why? Why does Haman get promoted? What did he ever do for anyone? It just seems to be somewhat out of the blue. Especially as the pasuk does seem to connect it to events at the end of the second chapter, Achar Hadvarim Ha'ele. Well, let's see what was dealt with at the end of the second chapter. That was the plotting of Bigthan and Teresh, and the matter was found out, and they were killed, and that's that. Next, we find Haman's promoted. So, seemingly, the promotion of Haman is connected to the plotting of Bigthan and Teresh. But that doesn't seem to be intuitive for us. The people involved were Mordechai and Esther. Haman wasn't involved. Bigthan and Teresh want to kill the king, and Mordechai finds out about it, and Esther tells the king about it. So, Mordechai's done the king a favor, Esther's done the king a favor, and put it all together, and Haman gets promoted. I mean, that sounds a little disjointed. Ma inyan Haman etzel Bigthan and Teresh. We should note that the Gemara has dealt with this first and foremost, and the Gemara here invokes the famous principle of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Makdim Refua Lamaka. Hashem always prepares the cure before the blow. And the idea behind that is that the goal is not the makkah itself. The goal is the refuah. That's why the refuah comes first. But there's certain healing that needs to be done. If the makkah came first, it almost sounds like Hashem is fine for the makkah to exist. And if they recover, they recover. By placing the refuah first, by placing the recovery first, Hashem is indicating that the goal is to recover. But there is recovery that needs to be done. In a sense, if we consider, what the Gemara is doing is explaining how these events are connected, even though they're not connected. And by that we mean, the refuah is that the favor has been done. Mordechai, his name is in the Divrei Hayomim. It's forgotten temporarily, it will come back. Things are in place for the miracle and salvation when it finally occurs. Once that's happened, Haman can be promoted. So if we watch carefully, the Gemara is telling us that these two events are connected, but not in the way that we would think. Achar hadvarim ha'ele normally denotes a causational connection, or a sequential connection, that A led to B. In this case, A didn't lead to B. The episode with Bigthan and Teresh didn't cause the promotion of Haman. It just had to be in place before Haman could be promoted. So they are connected not so much causationally, we could say, but organizationally. That means Hashem wants to ensure that that has happened before Haman is promoted. But nonetheless, the two are not essentially connected. That is what the Gemara says. However, we do find, or alongside that, we find that there are Mefarshim who do explain the connection between these two events, Bigthan and Teresh, and the promotion of Haman. And we turn our attention to the Yosef Lekach, who has guided us In the last couple of years, the classic Peirush on Megillas Esther by Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, he is the author of the Sefer Maase Hashem on the Chumash, and his Peirush Yosef Lekach is so foundational that the classic and perhaps better known commentaries on the Megillah are based in largely on his Peirush. The Peirush of the Vilna Gaon, the Peirush of the Malbim are all based on the Yosef Lekach. And he takes us back to the first time we meet Haman. He's called Memuchan, as the Gemara says. He's Muchan the Peronus. He's prepared for disaster, for retribution. And we note that Haman's advice to kill Vashti, which was seemingly contrary to where things were moving, they were looking to keep Vashti in play, Haman advises to kill her. But not only does he advise that move, but he also recommends the introduction of a new type of law into the constitution. We see in Perek Aleph that when Ahasuerus has an issue, he springs into action and consults his committees. There's a seemingly unending list of names of people that he has to deal with. Yodei Ha'itim, Yodei Dasvadin, Yoshim Rishon Ola Malchus, Karshan Ha'Shesar, and all those other individuals. He just doesn't know what to do. He seems to be bound by these committees. And along comes Haman and says, I have a recommendation for the king, and it's called Dvar Malchus. Yetzei Dvar Malchus Milifnei HaMelech. And Dvar Malchus means that if it's something that relates primarily to the king, first and foremost to the king, he can decide by himself. In a sense, Haman gave Ahasuerus power. He gave him the freedom to rule on something that relates significantly to him. Well, Ahasuerus took a liking to the idea, and he killed Vashti on Haman's recommendation. Against that background, so we look at the next episode of Bigson and Teresh, who are plotting to kill the king. We find something very interesting. The matter is found out, they are exposed, and very little happens after that. They just get killed. They're hanged. That's Ahasuerus is doing. And in a sense, this is his first field application of the new type of law that Haman gave him. This is Ahasuerus' first opportunity to flex his muscles as the king, and it's refreshing. It's good to be the king. That Bigthan and Teresh are plotting against him. He doesn't need to consult with anyone. And therefore, after that, he wishes to show his recognition to Haman for having given him that power, and thus he promotes Haman. This is the one who gave him that ability just to act unilaterally, independently, finally, as the king. That's how Yosef Lekach explains how the promotion of Haman was a result of the episode with Bigthan and Teresh. Rav Soloveitchik, I saw recently, has a parallel approach, which of course is fascinating and could be the subject of very extensive study. We know, and it's based on the Gemara, we're blessed with Maseches Megillah, a whole Masechta dealing with Purim, and the Gemara has an inbuilt commentary on Megillas Esther, from Daf Yud to Daf Tet Zayin. And the Gemara there tells us a bit of background. Ahasuerus was not born into the monarchy. Ahasuerus, he was rather of lowly status originally. Vashti made the mistake of insulting him and reminding him of his lowly origins. He was a stable boy in her grandfather's stables. But with determination and cruelty, he basically killed his way to power. And that being the case, Ahasuerus begins quite paranoid with regards to how people accept him. He knows that someone could do to him what he did to everybody else. I mean, it's a very uncomfortable way to live. And that's really what Haman was playing on in Perek Aleph, because when a person is insecure, especially if he's the king and he's in power, and he's insecure about his power, so if you begin to tell him that there are people and they could get ideas and they could plot to overthrow you, he'll stamp it out. And that's what Haman did. He took a domestic situation, It's a rather high-profile Shalom Bayis issue between Ahasuerus and Vashti. He turned it into a potential national rebellion. If Vashti gets away with it, all the women will get away with it, and Ukedai Bizayon will be bizarre for their husbands, Vaketzef, and anger. Who will be angry? The husbands will be angry. Angry at whom? At you. Do you want every single husband in the world angry at you? Ahasuerus doesn't want it. And therefore he follows Haman's recommendation and kills Vashti. And in his mind he has now laid to rest a potential rebellion, none of which actually existed. Haman had his own reasons for that. But now Ahasuerus feels that Haman has a talent for sniffing out these things, these conspiracies. You see, he detected the potential uprising, the Vashti-inspired uprising in Ahasuerus' mind. That was a very real thing. Haman convinced him of that. And we see that Ahasuerus is very wary of anyone. And Esther tells Mordechai, the rule is known throughout the kingdom. Anyone who turns up uninvited in Ahasuerus' courtyard is killed. I mean, there were no mishulachim there, that's for sure. And no one can turn up uninvited. But that is very heavy-handed paranoia, whereby if I didn't invite him, he must be here to kill me, so I have to kill him first. I mean, that's the climate that Ahasuerus lives in. Now, that being the case, when Bigtan and Teresh, which was really the only real live plot to overthrow Ahasuerus, was Bigtan and Teresh. But as soon as he came face to face with that, so he reminded himself of the expert in detecting these things. And therefore, having put Bigtan and Teresh to rest, he recalled Haman to be his advisor for all matters conspirational and promoted him. And thus did Haman, who fed Ahasuerus' paranoia, receive that promotion. In the end, Haman will yet be killed as a result of Ahasuerus' paranoia, but that's yet in the making. Those are the later prokem of Megillas Esther. So Haman has been promoted, and everyone has to show their respect. We find the next few psukim, Dochol Avdei HaMelech, Pasuk Beis, Dochol Avdei HaMelech, Hashem B'Shar HaMelech, all the king's servants in the courtyard, Kurim U'Mishtachavim LaHaman, they're all bowing down to Haman, Ki Chein Tziva Lo HaMelech, because that's what the king has commanded, except for Mordechai. Mordechai lo yuchav lo yishtachaveh. Now this caused a bit of consternation in the royal courtyard. Vayom rabdei hamelech, hasher b'shar hamelech, leMordechai, madu ata overes mitzvas hamelech? Why are you violating the king's command? And this happened for a number of days. Pasuk dalet, vayika amram, elav yom vayom v'lo shama alehem. They're exhorting on a daily basis. He's not listening. Vayagidu leHaman le'ros yamdu divrei Mordechai. And so they told this to Haman. So it's very interesting because in the next pasuk, Haman sees pasuk hey vayar Haman ki ein Mordechai kareh mishtachavelo vayimale Haman chema. In our synopsized version of the story, we would cut out a number of these days. As we tell the story, we say that everyone's meant to bow down to Haman, but Mordechai's not bowing down, and Haman gets upset, and then the story proceeds. But it's very interesting that there is no direct connection between Mordechai and Haman. That means Mordechai doesn't bow down and Haman doesn't react. Everyone else reacts. The servants of the king react. And they say, what are you doing? And Mordechai's not listening. And they tell Haman. So Haman doesn't know that Mordechai's not bowing down to him, apparently, until he's told. And then Haman sees, but where has he been? I mean, if everyone's bowing down to him, he must have been around. So why does it take such a roundabout route? It seems it's the servants that are ferrying the information here. Well, Yosef Lekach explains on a very simple level, and it's very matim for Haman. he didn't notice who wasn't bowing down to him. In other words, he was so secure and happy in his new position, he naturally assumed everyone's bowing down. I mean, most people are bowing down. He wasn't looking to check. In his gaiva, Haman is sure that, who wouldn't bow down to me? He doesn't notice if no one's bowing down. It's like he wouldn't notice if someone wasn't interested if he was talking to him. Of course he is. Everyone is. He's Haman. It was only the servants that noticed Mordechai. See, Haman doesn't concern himself with details. People are details for him. Everyone's bowing down. Of course they're bowing down. He doesn't even deign to look at them. Not to stare at them, to check. But the servants notice. And they're agitated. And they say to Mordechai, why are you doing this? And then, Mordechai's not listening. And in Pasuk Dalet it says, Vayagidu lehaman lir'os hayam du divrei Mordechai. So that's interesting, because the Yosef Lekach and others like him, we would translate, they told us to Haman, to see if Mordechai's word would stand. But the Yosef Lekach pauses at the word lir'os, as if to say, they told Haman to look. He hasn't looked yet. He hasn't noticed. But Mordechai's not paying the attention to them. So they said to Haman, lir'os. Look, and then we'll see if Mordechai is still not bowing down to him once Haman notices. And indeed, the chiddush here is in Pasuk, hey, vayar Haman. Haman does look for the first time. Mordechai is not bowing down. And Haman gets very upset. On a slightly more nuanced level, and this is from the Malbim, and again, it's based on the Yosef Lekach, but actually the Malbim detects a bit of a change within these psukim. We know from the Gemara that Haman either dangled an idol around his neck, or he considered himself to be an Avodah Zorah. And of course that can only help his profile for most people. But for Mordechai then it became an obstacle. He's not going to bow down to Haman, so certainly not with an idol, and even not without an idol, if Haman himself is an idol. So he's not listening. And that's what they notice, and they tell Haman. And therefore the end of Pasuk Dalet, where it says, Vayagidu lahaman lir'os hayamdu divrei Mordechai, so they wanted to test this. Mordechai, it seems, did not say more than that. In other words, he cited religious reasons. He doesn't want to make more of it than that, but he's not bowing down to Haman. So they told Haman, lir'os hayamdu divrei Mordechai, to see if Mordechai's word would stand, namely, that it's for religious reasons that he's not bowing down to Haman, ki higid lahem ashehu Yehudi, for he told them that he was a Yehudi. Now, the words are blindingly obvious. I mean, if people don't know that Mordechai is Jewish, who is Jewish if Mordechai is not Jewish? Why is that a chiddush? But the point is, ki yigid lahem ashehu yuhu Yehudi, he told them that's the reason why he's not bowing down to Haman. He doesn't want to make any more of it. He's not prepared to bow down under any circumstances. But if you tell me, if you ask me why you're not bowing down, so he mentions a religious factor for sacramental purposes only, not bowing down. But they wanted to test it. And therefore what happens in Pasuk Hay is that Haman, on the understanding that there was an Avodah Zorah issue, he removes the Avodah Zorah. And now what? Now we'll test his Mordechai's explanation. Except at this point it became personal. Vayar Haman ki ein Mordechai koreo umishtachaveh lo. That means even barring the Avodah Zorah issue, it's just person to person, Mordechai to Haman, Mordechai still not bowing down to Haman. At that point, Haman became upset. And that was really his own fault. He should have probably kept the Avodah Zorah on and left himself to his delusions. But he had to test it and to see, so if I remove the Avodah Zorah, still not bowing down, still not bowing down. And now Haman's upset. Now, in Pasuk Vav, we see that this is, one could certainly say, an overreaction to a personal issue. Vayivez be'einav lishloach yad b'mor l'chai levado. It was beneath him, degrading for him, just to target Mordechai. Ki yigidlo asam Mordechai, they told him Mordechai's nation, and therefore he wants to kill all the Jews. Vayivakeish Haman lashmid es kol ha'yudim asher b'chol machus achashverosh am Mordechai. How did this personal confrontation become all of a sudden a genocidal thing? But on the simplest level, I mean, the answer is in the pasuk itself. it's beneath Haman to have a personal altercation with someone. And therefore, it's only lefi kvodo, if it's him, against an entire people. And therefore, who's Mordechai's people? They're the Am HaYehudi. He'll take them all out. That's sufficiently high voltage for Haman to be involved in something like that. Not just one person. Which means there's a great irony in the story here, in the sense that Haman, as long as Mordechai's refusal to bow down to Haman was on religious grounds, Haman didn't mind. As soon as it was on personal grounds, he did mind. But he can't bring himself to respond to Mordechai on personal grounds. So he responds to him on religious grounds and is looking to wipe out his entire religion. So that's a bit of a palindrome in terms of just how what got him upset and how he reacted. He took it personally and responded nationally. And so he begins to plan and plot. Pasuk Yud Zayin. This is Chodesh Nisan, B'Chodesh HaRishon, Hu Chodesh Nisan, and we've noted in the past all the names in Megillas Esther, the names of the months, are numbered and named. Chodesh HaRishon, Hu Chodesh Nisan. Chodesh Nimasar, Hu Chodesh Adar. As the Ramban tells us in Parshas Bo, this was actually the time in history when there was a transition from referring to the months by number to referring to them by name. Until this point, they were only referred to from Nisan as Chodesh HaRishon, Chodesh HaSheni, Shlishi, etc. It's specifically when we came back from Bavel, we took those other names with us as a zecher for the Geula from Bavel. Adar, Nisan, and these are Babylonian names. And therefore, this transitional point, not everyone knows what Nisan is. They know what the first month is, and this is where, as we're guided, Chodesh HaRishon, which will henceforth be known as Nisan. Chodesh Neimasar, which will henceforth be known as Chodesh Adar, and so it is. Chodesh HaRishon, Pasuk Zayin, Chodesh Nisan, B'shtam Shtem Asei Lamelech HaHashverosh, so this is the 12th year, that's 9 years after the feast. He pil pur hagoral. He casts lots. Lefnei Haman, miyom leyom, what's the best day? Mechodesh lechodesh, what's the best month? And it became Chodesh Neimasar, Chodesh Adar. Came out to the 13th of Adar. Now, this part of the story for us, I believe, is not as meaningful as it really is, in the sense that we look upon the casting of lots as something very arbitrary. It's like rolling the dice or flipping a coin. So he cast the lots and it came out. He put a number of pieces of paper in a hat. And they're three-cornered, no doubt. And he took them out, Adar, and 13, and 13 is of Adar. And it doesn't really mean anything. It's entirely random and arbitrary. But we see that that is very far from what is happening here. Suffice it for us that the entire name of the festival is called Purim. Al Shem HaPur. I mean, it would seem to us to be of the less important or significant terms. That's true, there was a lot in the story, but there were lots of things in the story. I mean, there were horses in the story, and there was wine in the story, and there's a 50 cubit piece of wood in the story, but when you choose the name, we would have thought it would be something closer to the heart of what's going on. And of everything, it's called Purim. And the Pasuk talks about it. Al Kein Karu Le'yom Me'ele Purim. Al Shem HaPur. Which means that this idea of the poor needs closer attention from us to understand what it means. And the Vilna Gaon explains. The concept of a poor is not a random selection of a day. It's a way, using technology that for us is lost, of how to work out at what day of what month is the mazel of Haman at its apex and the mazel of the Jewish people, if there is such a thing, at its lowest point. So for us, our knowledge of mazalos is based on things which are very difficult to rely on at the best of times. We can predict other things. We can predict when it will rain or when it will snow. And that's something that they never used to be able to do. And they have a way of knowing where the mazel for Haman is strongest and the mazel for Yisroel is weakest. And what is the concept of mazel? The idea of mazel is the flow of forces into the world, which then augur well for some people, not well for others. Mazalos literally are constellations, and they are the medium through which divine influence is channeled into the world. And the word mazal itself comes from the word nozel, which is to flow, because it's the flow of events and it's the flow of input into the world and how people are affected by it. We say, ein mazel Yisrael. The Jewish people don't have mazel. Well, isn't that true? Ein mazel Yisrael. What it means, first and foremost, is that the Jewish people are affected primarily and directly from Hashem. That's what we mean when we say, ki chelek Hashem amo. We are the portion of Hashem. So mazalos never augur well for the Jewish people, in a sense, even at the best of times, not by themselves. As Mefarshim point out, according to the strict rules of mazalos, the Jewish people shouldn't really even exist, because our forefather Avram, before he was elevated above it, his mazal had him incapable of bearing children. Avram eino molid. Avraham molid. Hashem vayotzei oso achutza. Hashem took him outside of that system. So a system that doesn't recognize your existence is hardly likely to be kind to you. Which means that there is a positive side to that and a negative side, which even Zeresh actually picked up on. Zeresh, Haman's wife, who said a correct thing. When things began to go up for Mordechai, she said, you don't have a chance. If he's on the up and you're on down, you don't have a chance. You should get out while you can. Haman didn't listen. Because we're either raised above the mazalos or we suffer almost at the bottom of the mazalos, picking crumbs from whatever's left from the mazalos. And in a sense, this is the most meaningful way to present and express the miracle of Purim. Purim is a time when the Jewish people are at their most vulnerable. And the Vilna Gaon proceeds to explain why. When we talk about our connection with Hashem and the way that things are set up, for the world is set up with a certain system. For us, when we move into the world of spirituality, it sounds like there are no rules anymore, but that's superficial. The spiritual world and the spiritual running of the world also has rules. And there are places where Hashgacha is more felt, and there are entities that are conduits for divine supervision. From the time that we entered Eretz Yisrael, Hashgacha for the Jewish people has been localized in the land of Israel. And that's why the Pasuk says, Hashem's eyes are on the land of Israel. In Parshas Re'eh, Eretz Asher, Einei Hashem Elokecha Ba, Mereishis Hashana, Vat Achrishan. Hashem's eyes are on the land of Israel. Outside, apparently, less so. Moreover, when the Beis HaMikdash is standing, that's a conduit for divine supervision, all the more so, and there were open miracles in the Beis HaMikdash, and there was extended supervision for the land of Israel. And the implications for the Jewish people is that their place vis-a-vis mazalos is vouchsafed. They don't need to fear from all of those runnings of the world. Hashem is dealing with them and taking care of them directly. In fact, we find that one of the names of the Beis HaMikdash is called a sukkah. We say on sukkahs, Harachamanu Yakim Lanu, es sukkas David Hanofeles. Now, if you look at the Beis HaMikdash, it doesn't look like a sukkah. And that might even be perhaps not doing justice to the Beis HaMikdash. Why is it called a sukkah? The Vilna Gaon, in his Perush to Shir HaShirim, explains that a sukkah is primarily for shade from the sun. And the sun, in Jewish thought, really represents the mazalos. It's the closest star to us. And as the Pasuk says, it talks about the luminaries as being moshlim, es ha-shemesh limem sheles hayom, es ha-reach v'kochavim limem shalos balayla. That means that their sources, executive of course, not independent, but their sources through which of power, And that's how Hashem runs the world, through them. And that's the natural running of the world, through the mazolos. Mazolos are not kind to the Jewish people. Although you should still say thank you when someone wishes you mazel tov. I wouldn't respond by saying, ein mazel yisrael. They mean well. But mazolos are not kind to the Jewish people. The idea of the Beis HaMikdash as sukkah, shade from the sun. Shade from the sun means protection from any harmful effects of mazolos. The Jewish people are vouchsafed, protected, safeguarded by Hashem's direct supervision. And that's why the Pasuk says famously in Shir HaShirim, as the Yafa Banoshim, the beautiful amongst the women, who is the Jewish people, says, Al Teruni, don't look at me now. Shanish Charchores, I've been blackened. Shesh Zafashni HaShamish, I've been burnt by the sun. How did I get burnt by the sun? Samuni Notera Sakramim, they set me up guarding all the vineyards. Karmili Lonatarti, I didn't guard my own vineyard. If I guarded my own vineyard, I'd have a sukkah to protect me from the sun. The idea of the Yofa Banoshim, the idea of the Jewish people being burnt by the sun, is burnt by mazolos, exposed to mazolos without any protection. That's the Jewish people in Golos. I've been set to work in other people's vineyards. I didn't guard my own. If I guarded my own vineyard, I'd still be in Israel, protected by the sukkah of the Beis HaMikdash. And this is something that is well known to Haman. And indeed, the Medrash presents part of his original plan to Ahasuerus, as he wants to eradicate the Jewish people. And Ahasuerus says, I don't know that I want to start up with them. A lot of people have tried and failed. And to that, Haman responded, that's when they were on their land, and that's when they had the Beis HaMikdash. Then I wouldn't recommend it. But they're beyond the coverage that's extended to them by their God, and they're off location, beyond protection, and you'll be able to succeed. Of course, therefore, in a sense, the breakthrough of Purim, and the Vilna Gaon compares Purim to Hanukkah in this way, because we make a bigger Yom Tov out of Purim than we do Hanukkah. Yemei Mishta v'Simcha. More Hanukkah has mitzvahs, but it's not a Yom Tov like Purim is. Even though the miracles in Hanukkah were greater, Rabbi Biyad Matim and the miracle with the oil, the miracle on Purim was of a relatively lower level. That may well be. It may have had a lower miracle factor, says the Gaon. But you can't compare the situation in Purim to Hanukkah. Because Hanukkah, we were in Eretz Yisrael, and we had the Beis HaMikdash. It was somewhat not at full function. But for any miracle to happen in Chutz La'aretz without a Beis HaMikdash is a greater chiddush than whatever happened during the time of Hanukkah. And this is part now of the Goral of Haman. Indeed, there's a very enigmatic statement in the Gemara. I think it's well known. Because when Haman saw that the Goral landed on the month of Adar, which, although it's a very long time, because it's Chodesh Nisan now. I mean, that's almost as far away as you can get. It's 11 months. 11 months, it's a long time in politics. But from a certain point of view, he had to wait, but he was happy. Why is he happy? Because the Adar is the month that Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. Wow. Haman knows when Moshe passes away. And therefore, it's a good month for Haman. It's a bad month for the Jewish people. But the Gemara says he was a chacham, but he was a halba chacham. He knew the yahrzeit, but he didn't know that he was actually also born in that month, and even actually on that very day. If he knew that, apparently he wouldn't be so happy. Except what difference does it make? Moshe passes away during that month, and he was born during that month. How is this affecting Haman? But the Maharal explains the passing of Moshe. Moshe is not just a historical figure, and Haman knows that. Moshe represents the highest point of direct supervision and protection for the Jewish people. As long as Moshe is there, Hashem is with us, with the Anan, with the Amud Eish, and man is falling, and everything, we're being led directly. That's what Moshe represents. When Hashem told him that he was going to lead through a malach in Parshas Kisisa, Moshe campaigns against it. Hashem says, Hinei anochi sholeach malach lefanecha. Moshe is not having it. He davens to have that reversed. To guide us through a malach means to guide us indirectly. And Moshe says, only direct. Im ein panecha holchim, al taleinu mizeh. Halo belechtecha imanu. We want you with us. We don't want a malach. We want you. And Hashem listened. Hashem granted his request. only as long as Moshe was alive. As soon as Moshe passed away, then the guiding of the Jewish people really did come through a malach. That's the malach that appeared to Yehoshua just on the eve of battle. Anisar Tzva Hashem Atabasi. That's the malach. Finally came. Atabasi. Now I've arrived. I've been held off by Moshe for 40 years. But now I'm here. Which means that if Moshe represents this, the highest potency of divine protection, so the passing of Moshe would seem to be an auspicious time for Haman, because it represents the lessening of divine protection. And perhaps Haman hopes even the cessation of divine protection. It's a good time for Haman. However, says Maharal in the Sefer Or Chodosh, Haman didn't realize that Moshe was also born on the 7th of Adar. What difference does it make if he's born? So the Maharal says a very deep thing. If a person dies, so then that sounds like that's the end. Because if you look at their life in a straight line, so that's the end of the line. But if a person dies on the day that they're born, so that's not a straight line. That's actually, that comes back to where it is in the beginning. That's a circle, and a circle doesn't end. In other words, the notion of Moshe passing away on the day he was born means his life was complete. Complete and terminated are not the same thing. Terminated means it's no more. Complete means Moshe's role is finished and now it will continue. And therefore, whereas we didn't always have the overt protection that we had in the Midbar, but Moshe's life cycle completed its mission and Hashem's supervision with the Jewish people is always there in one form or another. That was the bad news for Haman. Moshe was born on that day as well. And therefore, with this in mind, we get at least a bit of a deeper insight into the Pur and the Goral, and the expression of the miracle of Purim is that Hashem, if we get ourselves together, will never leave us at the mercy of Mazalos wherever we are. He will find a way to maneuver events to our salvation and to our triumph. And that's Chuasa Ma'isa LeNetzach. That is an everlasting message, and that's why it's Tikvasa Mechol Dovador, hope for each and every generation. Subsequent generations might find themselves in a place like the Jewish people did. Let them learn the message from Purim that they thought they were lost, but the message is the Jewish people are never lost. And that is worth naming the entire festival after that idea. It's called Purim Al Shem HaPur. But that's moving far ahead. We are currently at the stage where Haman is plotting. And what does he want? Pasuk. Well, we see his plans. I mean, they will be expressed in further psukim. But Haman seeks to destroy the Jewish people. He's unsuccessful. And we celebrate. And we celebrate, actually, in four ways. Which is quite a lot for one day. Very little idle time on the Purim. Firstly, there's the reading of the Megillah. Secondly, there's the Su'uda, the Mishta, which is a Su'udas mitzvah, eating and drinking. Thirdly, the Gaon classifies this as its own idea, Simcha. And fourthly, there are the mitzvahs, the interpersonal mitzvahs. Mishloach Manos, Matanos Lev Yonim. There's really a lot going on in many different directions. And the Gaon explains how these four mitzvahs came about. It's a lot. I mean, each one could really mark the miracle by itself. But we have four of them. And the reason why is because Haman's plans for the Jewish people, which you'll see at the end of the Perek, are referred to as Lashmid, Larog, Labeid, and Ushlalam Lavos, to destroy, to kill, to eradicate, and all of their property will then be collectible, can be pillaged. What's behind this four-part plan for Haman? So the Gaon explains, a person in the fullest depiction really has four aspects to him. There is his physical existence, physical body. There is his life in that body, his ruach. There's his mind. And there are his possessions. Your average person who's doing well has all of those four things. And Haman was looking for an absolute annihilation on every single level. And therefore, we put these terms together, Lashmid, Larog, Labed. They're almost like it's three words which are really one word, but that's not the case. Lashmid, Larog, Labed are three separate things. Lashmid, the Gaon explains, is what we call Shmad. That is to say, to destroy them spiritually, either as a separate program, or perhaps once they're dead, then that's the end of their spiritual existence as well. But he's looking to remove the spiritual entity called the Jewish people from the world. La rogue, of course, is to kill, but then la abed, and this is a terrifying thing that the Gaon is saying, but la abed was not only to kill them, but to then remove any trace of their existence. Nothing should remain, not even a dead body. La abed should be lost. And shlalom lavos. And all of their property then available. There should be no, all Jewish wealth would be plundered and commandeered. That is an absolute destruction. And therefore, as the Jewish people are saved and all of that is reversed, as we find, so corresponding, says the Gaon, to every element that Haman was looking to destroy us, we celebrate. Which means his first point was Lahashmid, right, to remove the spiritual existence of the Jewish people, and we celebrate that with reading the Megillah. The Megillah is one of the 24 books of the Tanakh. Haman, much to his horror, I'm sure he still hasn't recovered, was instrumental in giving the Jewish people another book of Tanakh, and a Masechta of Mishnayos and Gemara. That's before we get to the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. La rog is to kill them, that's to say, to remove their life. Well, how do you celebrate someone's inability to remove your life? What with what? With being alive? So the Gaon says, and the Netziv echoes this on many occasions, a person is their most alive when they're happy. And therefore the mitzvah, in a sense, of simcha on Purim, I would say it's almost like persumi nissa. As if to say, Haman has tried to kill us. Here's how not dead we are. Right? That happy, yeah? Every Jew, in a sense, on Purim, is like a walking menorah. I mean, the physical presence of a happy Jew is itself persumi nissa. In fact, some of them even begin to glow after a while. Well, la'abed then is to destroy any physical trace of the Jewish people. Well, the opposite of being destroyed physically is expanding physically, says the Gaon, and that's where there's a mitzvah to eat and drink on Purim. And finally, shlalom lavos, no Jewish property left. And how do we respond? It's a mitzvah. We give things to people. We give gifts to the poor. We give gifts to our friends. Matanos Levyonim and Mishloach Manos. A very beautiful, sweeping survey of the mitzvahs of Purim, where they come from, and how they are aligned with each other. So now, Haman comes to Ahasuerus, and he has to present his case. Vayomer Haman l'melech Ahasuerus. This is in Pasuk Ches. Yeshno am echad. There is a nation, Mefuzar, Umeferet, Bein Ha'amim, they're spread out, they're apart. And all the nations, Bechom, Medinos, Bachusech, and all of your kingdom, V'dasehem, Shanos, Mikal'am, their laws, their religion, is different than others. V'stasei HaMelech Einam Osim, they don't keep the king's laws, V'lamelech Ein Shoveh L'Hanicham. That is the ultimate slander of the Jewish people. Yosef Lekach explains, Ahasuerus should have three reasons why he wouldn't really want to do this to any nation. Firstly, you destroy a nation and then your kingdom is diminished. People who have many states in their kingdom, they like to have that number. They don't like to have one of them deleted. That's a diminishing of the monarchy. Secondly, it can cause a great deal of instability in the kingdom. One people gets targeted and just eliminated, how do you think all the other people feel? probably not so secure. And Ahasuerus doesn't want people to feel insecure. No one would. Certainly Ahasuerus doesn't. And moreover, if they're contributing to the monarchy, so then that contribution will disappear. Haman, in his Lishna Bisha, in his slander against the Jewish people, seeks to address all of these points. Number one, he says that there's this nation, they are mefuza, they're spread out. What does he mean by saying they're spread out? What he means is they're not a state. They're not really a people. They're not any number in the 127. And really what that means is they're kind of everywhere, but they're nowhere specific. So you could, even if you would get rid of all of them, your kingdom would not be diminished. It'd still be 127. Some people would have more land. Secondly, mefurad, and this is really a very chilling thing that Haman says. Mefurad, they're apart, meaning not only are they separate, but they're apart. They keep themselves apart. And because they keep themselves apart, no one really feels that they have anything in common with them. And what that means is, if you would get rid of them, no one else would feel unsafe. Because they don't feel any camaraderie with them, or connection with them. And they could actually watch them disappear and feel as if nothing's happened. And that's what it means, they're mefurad, they're apart from people. And moreover, if we watch carefully the words here in Pasuk Ches, it says, V'daseihem shonim mikol am. Their laws are shonim mikol am, are different from others. Now grammatically, actually, a law is a law and others are people. It should have said their laws are different than other people's laws. You can't have a law. A law and a person can't be similar or dissimilar. It should have said, V'daseihem shonim mikol am. But what Haman is saying is, their laws are about keeping them different from people. That's their whole approach. Shonus mikol am. And one often wonders if all the things that are said about the annihilation of the Jewish people, if a typist error would actually bring, mistakenly mention another country, the whole world would feel unsafe. But when it's Israel, everyone feels quite safe. And moreover, it says, V'daseh ha-melech einam osim, and they don't really do the king's laws. They don't really contribute, not meaningfully. The only thing you could say they contribute is money. Well, then Haman is prepared to pay out money in their stead. That's his famous Aseres Alafim Kikar Kesef. And part of what he's saying is, if they don't keep the king's laws, then maybe they represent a potential fifth column, really, as far as the monarchy is concerned. And this, once again, is Haman playing on Ahasuerus' paranoia. That means that you've got these people, they're all over the place, right? That sounds familiar. They're everywhere, and there's something about them. And they're not doing what everyone else is doing, and that's really un-Persian behavior, un-monarchy-friendly behavior. That if they got themselves together, they could really mobilize and cause a great deal of trouble. And once again, Ahasuerus, when he hears that type of thing, but Amelech ein shoveh, it's not worth it for you to keep them. They are a problem waiting to erupt for you. And the king can decide by himself, because we come back to the concept of Devar Malchus, if it's really about the king, which is important, because if they had to go through all the panels and all of the, there's a good chance that this would not have gone through. But it's this secret channel, this special branch called Devar Malchus. It's just between Haman and Ahasuerus. We should note that Haman is very deliberately vague about who he's talking about and what he wants to do with them. We mentioned that Haman's plans were Lahashmid, Laharog, Ulaabed, could not be clearer. But when he comes to Ahasuerus, so firstly in Pasuk Ches, Yishno Amechad, there's a nation. You don't want to say which nation you're talking about? He doesn't want to say. Does Ahasuerus know? Probably. Possibly. He doesn't know. It could be any nation. How many nations fit that profile? He's not curious. Except Haman, in a sense, is looking to make it easier for Ahasuerus. They don't actually have to say explicitly who they're talking about, even if they both know. So that he's giving Ahasuerus maximum distance from the plan. There's a nation, no need to talk about names, and we don't know who it is, and it could be anyone really, and that's enough that needs to be said. Moreover, in Pasuk Tes, it says, if you don't mind, if it's good for you, I think it is good for you, let it be written, la'abdam. We see how words here are sanitizing things and obfuscating things. That means that originally, la'shmid, la'rog, la'abed, is to kill them. But when he talks to him, he doesn't talk in such graphic terms, such specific terms. He talks in much more euphemistic terms, la'abdam. La'abdam means to lose them. There's many ways that a nation can be lost. It could be through killing them. It could be through naturalizing them. In other words, let's just try and make them a bit more Persian. That could also be la'abdam. That's just to be lost as a people. No one needs to get hurt. That's a project. It's a good project. They become good Persians. Yikasev la'abdam. And he does this for Ahasuerus's benefit, that it doesn't have to even have sounded that bad for Ahasuerus to say yes. Even though there's almost like an alien consciousness. They know who they're talking about. It makes a difference that no one actually said anything, and everyone's more comfortable, and it goes through more smoothly. And this brings us back to a very important point with regards to Ahasuerus, namely, what type of person was Ahasuerus? Was he a good person? Was he a bad person? If you look through the Megillah, the villain is Haman. Read the Psukim. And if you look at Ahasuerus, he seems to be slightly gullible and perhaps a bit manipulated, but it doesn't have the best middos, but in terms of a villain, we don't see him that way. If you look in the Gemara, you just have to start reading the Megillah with Rashi's Perush, and it's from the Gemara. He's a Rasha from the beginning to end. He's a Rasha before Haman's a Rasha. The very first pasuk, Vayhi b'mei Ahasuerus, Hu Ahasuerus, says Rashi, Hu Ahasuerus, Hu Berisho, mitchilosa v'atzofa. He's a Rasha from beginning to end. But it's not explicit in the Megillah. And the Yosef Lekach has such a major point about this. For he says that, don't forget, even when the miracle happened and the Purim story reached its realization and we were saved, we're still under the dominion of Ahasuerus. In the words of the Gemara, Akati Abdi Ahasuerus Hanan, we're still the servants of Ahasuerus. If the subtotal of the miracle is that he was able to change his mind and reverse his plan against the Jewish people, but we're still, in a sense, under his control. We're still in Golas. So, the story of Purim was written there and then, and it was sent everywhere. There is no question that one of the first people to receive a leather-bound copy of the Megillah was Ahasuerus. Which means that there are certain things that cannot be stated explicitly about Ahasuerus. For example, that he's a Rasha from beginning to end. Because in the very first pasuk of the celebratory Megillah, you could just bring about a complete reversal of the miracle, if they're out there for their Ahasuerus' mercy. And therefore, it's a fascinating element of the hiddenness within the Megillah. Because there are certain things that are hidden, you need to know how to read. If you know how to read the words properly, one thing we can be sure of, when they presented Ahasuerus with his copy of Megillah Esther, it was not with Rashi's commentary. So when he reads, Vayhi b'mei Ahasuerus, Hu Ahasuerus, this is his favorite book. It's got one of his favorite characters. It's been mentioned twice in the opening sentence. So everyone's happy. But if you know how Esther writes, and if you know how Mordechai writes, and it's written Beruach HaKodesh, and you have Chazal, and you have Yom Haserah, and you know from what things were like, everything takes on a completely different coloring. And thus, he may have been portrayed in the Psukim as being slightly duped by Haman, but read the lines, read between the lines, and read properly, and then you get the full picture of Ahasuerus. Now the final point in the Psukim here is in Pasuk Yud Beis and Yud Gimel, because Ahasuerus agrees, and let's see Pasuk Yud Beis and Yud Gimel, Vayikar'u Sefer HaMelech B'chodesh HaRishon. Again, it's the 13th of Nisan, it's 11 months before the time. But Haman doesn't want to wait. He wants to get things going as soon as possible. B'shloshes ar yom bo, v'yikaseiv k'cholah she'tziva Haman al chashtapaneh ha'melech v'lapachos. It's everything that Haman told the rulers of all the provinces, Asher medina medina, am va'am, medina medina kirsava, am va'am kirshono, signed and sealed, b'shem ha'melech ha'chashvirish nechtav, v'nechtam b'tabas ha'melech. And what does it say? What's the message? Loud and clear, v'nishloch svarim b'yad ha'ratzim, there were letters sent with the runners, el kol medinos ha'melech, la'shmid, la'rog, la'beid, eskole yudim, minar v'atzakein, tafanashim, b'yom echad. Absolutely wiped out in one day, chodesh le'masar, chodesh le'masar, pardon me, chodesh, v'shloshar sal chodesh le'masar, chodesh adar, u'shlalam lavos. So that message goes out, and then, posuk yudalad, pashegen ha'kasav, pashegen is like the contents, almost like a synopsis. This is the rule in every nation. Open before everyone. To be ready. And here the Yosef Lekach says there is a major difference here between these two psukim. Pasuk Yud Beis and Yud Gimel describe a letter that was sent to the leaders of each province or state. Pasuk Yud Dalet describes the shorter letter that was said to everyone. And that everyone knew. And they were not the same contents. The letter sent to the leaders was much more explicit. As the Pasuk says, Lashmid, Larog, Labeit. They should know, but no one else can know. They've got to know what's going to be waiting, but no one else can know. Because Haman wants to keep it a secret. He wants to keep it a secret. He doesn't want the Jewish people to mobilize. That's top secret. So, does anyone know anything? Kind of. Pasuk Yudalet, Pashegen Aksav. The censored version. Linas in das bechol medina medina galoy lechol amim. What's revealed to everyone? Lios hasidim liyomazeh. Be ready. Be ready. The entire world was in a state of suspense, because the little people, the proletariat, right, who didn't know what it was about. All they had, everyone knows. The king says, 13th of Adar, be ready. Be ready for what? No one knows. And that's why it was a very strange situation. The people on top know what it's about. They're not saying. The people down below, no one knows. And that's why it's a strange thing, because if they don't need to know, but it's so far in advance, it's 11 months. So the final pasuk reads, Haratzim yatzud chufim etvar ha-melech, v'adas nitam b'shushan ha-bira. In Shushan ha-bira, in that smaller city, people know. But v'amelech v'aman yoshvu lishtos, v'ayu shushan ha-vocha. The king and Haman, they sit down to drink. And the city of Shushan, Navocha means confused. Why are they confused? They have no idea what's going on. Shushan Habira, as we've noted from Rebbe Margolius in the past, is the capital city. Ir Shushan is the broader city. And in Shushan Habira, people know, but no one's saying. But in Shushan itself, no one knows. Interesting, the minhag is to read this pasuk like in the Eicha tune, which in a sense gives a very tragic connotation to the word Navocha. But Navocha doesn't mean sad. Navocha means confused. And the reason why they're confused is because everybody knows you've got to be ready. No one knows for what. On the one hand, horses are running in all directions. It sounds like it's the most urgent thing in the world. On the other hand, Haman and Ahasuerus are sitting down. They're having a bit of a drink together. It sounds like there's nothing really urgent going on at all. And the people of Shushan are there, they're helplessly and haplessly looking at all of this. They have no idea what's going on. And that's exactly the way Haman wanted them to remain, that it should stay a secret as long as possible. In the end, Mordechai, of course, finds out rather rapidly, which is the beginning of the unraveling of Haman's plans, and it only works to our advantage that most of the letters sent out didn't really say what everyone needs to be ready for. It made it all the much easier to modify that edict when the time came to rewrite it, in a sense. But that, of course, is in later chapters. We'll have to leave that for another time. But for the time being, we have Perek Gimel with the Perush of Yosef Lekach. And as we see, the more we look into the psukim here, the more dimensions and the more layers and elements of the story are uncovered. Kedarka Shel Torah. We'll leave it over there.